Awake, awake, put on your strength, O Zion. Put on your beautiful garments, O Jerusalem, the holy city. Remember that the background to this challenge is the Babylonian captivity of the Jews. And the Jews have been sitting in Babylon for 70 years as slaves. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. And the picture here in these opening verses of Isaiah 52 is of a church that is half asleep. There is a heaviness on the people of God. They have become sluggish and lethargic and pathetic. And apparently this is something that is often true of many long-term prisoners in jail. Their life lacks any real sense of purpose or fulfillment. And so they drag out an existence in their cells, and they become depressed and dejected and downcast and even suicidal in their hopelessness. Long-term captivity. 70 years in Babylon. Sometimes we sing in the hymn, "Each victory will help you some other to win." And that is true. Each victory will help you some other to win. But alas, the converse is also true. If victory breeds victory, and it certainly does in the Christian life, because when you win one battle, it helps you to win other battles, then defeat also breeds defeat. And very often, once a man is down and defeated, very often the only thing he wants to do is go on being defeated. Defeat breeds defeat, just as victory breeds victory. And so God here is speaking to a defeated and a demoralized captive church. Shake yourself, says God. Waken up. Rouse yourself. Put on your strength and put on your beautiful garments. Take off your prison clothes, your garments of shame and of failure, and put on your new clothes. Awake, awake, Zion. Put on your beautiful garments, O Jerusalem. And I think there are two important things worth noticing about this challenge. The first is this. This is very good psychology, quite apart from being true. It is good psychology. It is a healthy and a health-giving thing to tell a man to shake himself and pick himself up and put on his new clothes, on the assumption, of course, that he has new clothes to put on. There's no point in telling a man to put on new clothes if he doesn't have any new clothes. But if you are a Christian, then you do have new clothes. Awake, awake, put on your strength, put on your beautiful garments. That's good psychology. You find on another level the same sort of good psychology in daily life. When a housewife gets a bit depressed, she may go off and get herself a good hairdo. That also is good psychology, although she may get a shock when she sees the bill. Or she may buy herself a new dress or a new pair of shoes just to smarten herself up a bit. You should see the looks of delight on the faces of old people in old folks' homes when the day comes for the hairdresser to arrive and to do them up, as they sometimes say. It's an odd expression, the hairdresser's coming to do us up. You should see the smile on their faces. It's good psychology. And so it is with the church. Christians need to be told from time to time to get out of the dust of despair and put on their robes of strength and of beauty. Because believe me, there are robes of strength and beauty that you can put on. Are you feeling downcast tonight and dejected? Are you sitting in the dust of shame and despair and failure? Awake, awake, put on your strength, O Zion. Put on your beautiful garments, O Jerusalem, the holy city. That's good psychology. The second thing is this. In order, this order to awaken up to the church should be seen in its proper context. It relates back to the previous chapter and to the 17th verse of that chapter, chapter 51 and verse 17, where you get the same sort of command. And God says, rouse yourself, rouse yourself, stand up, O Jerusalem. And it's the same sort of picture of a church that is sitting in the dust and the ashes of shame and despair. And God says here in verse 70, come on now, pull yourself together, get on your feet, shake yourself down and put on your new clothes. Rouse yourself, stand up, O Jerusalem. And that verse in turn relates back to a previous verse in chapter 51 in verse 9, chapter 1 and verse 9. Where we read these words, awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of the Lord, awake, as in days of old, the generations of long ago. Was it not thou that didst cut Rahab the monster in pieces, that did pierce the dragon of Egypt? Awake, awake, put on strength, arm of the Lord. And this is a picture of a church that somehow imagines that God is asleep, or God is dozing off, or God is forgetful of them. And what the church wants to see here in chapter 1 and verse 9 is God in action again. Awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of the Lord. And it is as if the church were saying to God in that verse, now God, just look at what you used to do in the old days. You're the God who brought the nation out of Egypt. You are the God who defeated Rahab, the sea monster. You are the God who parted the waves. Now, do it again. I wonder if that rings a bell in your mind as we move towards the end of the 20th century. The only century since the Reformation that has not seen a major world revival. Do it again. And many Christians have been praying that prayer this century for over 80 years. Christians have looked back on God's mighty acts and his interventions in the past. Christians since the turn of this century have looked back to the great evangelical movements of last century, to 1873, to Moody and Sankey, to 1859, the great evangelical awakening, to the early 1800s, Andrew Bonar, Horatius Bonar, Murray McChain, and before that, the evangelical awakening under the Wesleys, and George Whitfield, and Jonathan Edwards, and before that, to the work of the English Puritans and the Scottish Puritans, to the Cambuslang revival, the Cambuslang Wark, and to the Kilsyth revival. Christians since the turn of this century have been praying this prayer. Do it again! Do it again! Awake, awake, put on strength, arm of the Lord. Awake as in days of old, the generations of long ago. And the hope of these prayers is that one day God will come home to Zion. I wonder if you noticed that lovely phrase in the heart of chapter 52 as we read it. Verse 8, hark, your watchmen lift up their voice. Together they sing for joy this wonderful word, for eye to eye. Eye to eye, they see the return of the Lord to Zion. And that is the hope of this prayer. Do it again, Lord. Eye to eye, the return of the Lord to Zion. I can recall how intense this hope was at the end of the Second World War. You know that there was, when the war ended, there was a general longing for a new world. And many of the men who had been in the conflict and had seen all the horrors and the ghastliness of the war, they came home and they started attending church. And many of them were men who had never gone to church before the war. And they started coming back to church out of gratitude to God for his goodness in preserving them alive and keeping them safe. And there were real hopes in the late 1940s that there would be a spiritual awakening in our land. But of course, that did not materialize. Because what did the men find in the churches? They found decrepitude and decay and a musty, old-fashioned smell. They found morality and ethics, but very, very little gospel. And so they drifted away. And the state of affairs today in the churches is a direct result of their drifting away. It's a direct result of their disillusionment and their disappointment at the end of the war. And in fact, there is today very little sign of a major spiritual awakening. Awake, awake, arm of the Lord. There were some people who thought that the work of George MacLeod in the Iona community was the answer to that prayer. The Iona community, with all its stress on social and political involvement. But I don't think the Iona community is the answer to that prayer, because the Iona community is running out of steam. There are some who think that the various neo-Pentecostal and the charismatic movements of our generation are the answer to this prayer, "Awake, awake, arm of the Lord." And there are even some who think that all the special efforts that we hear of from the church headquarters in Edinburgh are the answer. All the things that have come to us since the war, the parish development program, campaigns for this and that, stewardship campaigns, efforts of all sorts, and very soon this year there's a new thing coming down from the General Assembly, an urgent call to the Kirk, it's called, challenging the church to come back to an evangelical position, challenging the church to return to the Word of God and to prayer and to a whole spiritual emphasis in the church today. And that is coming down this year from the General Assembly. It's called an urgent call to the Kirk. You know, somebody contain me, please. I am very amused by the men who nowadays call themselves evangelicals just because they see the churches on their last legs. There are men today who call themselves evangelicals who 10 years ago reviled the name and poured despite and scorn on it. And it's now being used as a mere convenience to keep the churches alive. I'm going to print this urgent call to the Kirk in the next parish magazine if I'm spared. October. Read it. I've been saying these things for 23 years. Mr. Still, my minister in Aberdeen, has been saying them for 40 years. Evangelicals in Scotland have been saying them for 400 years. People aren't interested. Read that urgent call to the Kirk. I agree with all of it says. But I don't think that's the answer to the prayer. Awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of the Lord, awake as in days of old, the generations of long ago. Do it again, God! The answer has not come, but the prayer still stands. And on the grounds of that prayer, in which God is challenged to do it again, Zion is commanded in 52 and verse 1 to put on her strength and her new clothes. Awake, awake, put on your strength, O Zion. Put on your beautiful garments, O Jerusalem, the holy city. And along with that call to waken up, Isaiah gives us here also two visions and insights. They're very memorable. The first vision is a vision of what it means to be a slave in verses 3 and 4 and 5. And then in verse 11,
There is the vision of what it means to be sanctified. Slavery and sanctification. And it's from the one to the other. Actually, my friend, that is the gospel of Jesus Christ in a nutshell. We move from slavery to sanctification. The slavery is hinted at in verse 2. Shake yourself from the dust, captive Jerusalem. And the dust there is the dust of death and of shame and of bondage. And that's what it means to be a sinner, to be sitting in the dust of shame and of death and of bondage. And the bonds are referred to also in verse 2. Loose the bonds from your neck, captive daughter of Zion. That also is what it means to be a sinner, because to be a sinner is to be a slave. See, we think of sin in a wrong way. We think of it as a kind of casual thing, as if it were something sort of sellotaped onto man's life. Doing X wrong, and you sellotape it on, you stick it on as if sin were a kind of appendage stuck onto a creature who is pretty good at heart. But that's not how the Bible thinks of sin. The Bible always thinks of sin in terms of bondage. That is the exact nature of slavery. In verse 2, the dust of shame and bondage and failure, and the bonds of slavery to sin. But the really indicative phrases that describe the slavery from which Christ wants to deliver us are the phrase, there are two really. The first is sold for nothing. You remember it occurred three times in verse 3 and verse 4 and verse 5. For nothing. And the other phrase is in the middle of verse 4, into Egypt to sojourn. Sold for nothing. Well, as we say, don't we? Cheap at the price. And don't you think that's very true of human experience? That we sell our souls cheap. Only one little drink. Come on now, don't be a spoil sport. Come on, be one of the lads. Only one little lie. Only one dishonest deal. Only one shady transaction. Only a slight cooking of the books. You know, nothing outrageous enough to cause a scandal or land you in jail. Only one apparently innocent flirtation. Only a harmless love affair. Sold sold for nothing. What did it cost Adam? A mouthful of fruit. That was pretty cheap. What did it cost Lot's wife? A look. She turned back. She looked. Pretty cheap. What did it cost Esau? A plate of lentil soup. That didn't cost much. What did it cost Judas? 30 pieces of silver. That wasn't much. What did it cost the prodigal son? Well, wasn't it perfectly natural for a young chap to want to branch out and be independent of his parents and his home and go his own way and grow up and be free? Not all right. I was staying with a friend in Edinburgh this week, and he told me the very moving story of his Uncle George. Many, many years ago, 80 years ago, and his Uncle George was an able young fellow, and he felt called by God to preach the gospel. And he did a little bit of preaching, and he preached with great success. And so he enrolled as a student for the ministry. One day he preached, and he came down to the vestry. And in the vestry, the minister gave him a dram. And you know, he renounced his call to the ministry. And he lived and he died a drunkard. And it was a minister who taught him to drink. Sold for nothing. What would you say was the price of your eternal soul? You see, to be a sinner is to be a slave. It is to sell yourself into bondage. And the second phrase that describes our slavery before Christ comes is into Egypt to sojourn. Verse 4, into Egypt to sojourn. Now, I stand corrected here, but I often wonder whether the Jews should have been in Egypt at all. You remember they had come to Egypt because Joseph was the chancellor and the prime minister. And after Joseph died, should they not all have gone back to the land? After all, God had made no promises to the Jews about Egypt. He didn't say anything about a heritage in Egypt. All the promises of God were his heritage in the land. And the promises of God to the Jews were anchored to the land. Why did they settle down in Egypt after Joseph died? Did they too sell themselves for nothing? Into Egypt to sojourn. And it was the fact that they settled down in Egypt that was wrong. You remember the start of the story of the book of Ruth, and how Elimelech and Naomi, in a time of famine, wandered from the Holy Land across the river Jordan into the land of Moab for bread. And they found bread in Moab, and they settled down there. Now, of course, there was nothing wrong with going to Moab for bread. But they settled down. And that was what made Elimelech and Naomi a prodigal father and mother. Do you remember the prodigal son? He went to the far country and he wanted to be free. There's nothing wrong with that. We all need to struggle into some kind of independence. But he lived there. And that was what made him a prodigal. He settled down, and the far country became his way of life. Is there anyone here tonight living in the far country? Are you far from God? Far from your true home? Far from love? Far from safety? Have you settled down? Are you a prodigal? Sold for nothing into Egypt to sojourn. That's what it means to be a slave. And the progress of the gospel is from that condition to a condition of sanctification. And these are the indicative words here in verse 11. Has that clock stopped? Can't be 7:05. It's 7:25. Mercy. Goodness me. It's at 7:05. I could hardly believe that. It's always stopping. Verse 11. Here are the indicative words, and this is what we're moving towards. Depart, depart, go out thence, touch no unclean thing. Go out from the midst of her, this is Babylon, these words. Purify yourselves, you who bear the vessels of the Lord. Of course, what is in mind here is the tabernacle and the temple worship of the Old Testament days, and the priests and the Levites who carried the vessels of the Lord in their duties were men who were expected to be separated men and holy men. Now, I think this is a very appropriate word for communion on this Lord's Day evening. Purify yourselves, you who bear the vessels of the Lord, those who handle the vessels of God in God's house, not just the elders, but ourselves, are to be separated men and women. The progress is from slavery to sanctification. Now, the subject of sanctification is a very big one, and various Christian groups have called it by different names. In a previous generation, it used to be called the blessing of a clean heart. the Salvation Army used to call it, although the army has changed a bit now, the blessing of holiness. The faith mission calls it the second blessing. Charles and John Wesley used to call it sanctification in love. We are separated in love to belong to Jesus and to belong to each other. And Christians over the years have exhibited their separation in different ways. The Puritans in our own country did it in their own way by wearing dark clothes, and they thought that black clothes were an expression of holiness. Over in America, the Amish sect expressed their separation in their own way by wearing rather old-fashioned clothes and by not using radios or television sets. There are some Christians who exhibit their separation by becoming teetotal in the matter of the drinking of alcohol. And other Christians eschew certain habits and certain forms of pleasure and of worldliness that are perhaps not wrong in themselves, but are compromising in relation to a Christian testimony. And all of these are outward, visible signs of the inward, spiritual reality of separation. But however you express your separation, the Bible certainly calls us to the inward reality of sanctification. Here is how Paul puts it in the opening verse of his letter to the Romans. Paul, an apostle of Jesus Christ, separated unto the gospel of God. Paul, separated, set aside, private property, and according to the New Testament, that is the only appropriate response to salvation by grace. The progress is from slavery to sanctification. We have been redeemed as Christians from bondage, sold for nothing, sojourning in Egypt. We are redeemed from bondage, not to belong to ourselves, but to belong exclusively to Him who loved us and gave Himself for us. In the end of the day, I think it was C.S. Lewis who first indicated this. In the end of the day, a man never belongs to himself. You are either the slave of sin, of wrong habits and self-centeredness, or you are the slave of Christ. Purify yourselves, you who bear the vessels of the Lord. You are either a slave to self or a slave to Christ. Here's how John puts it. Any man who has this hope purifies himself, even as he is pure. In that spirit, we come now to the Lord's Supper. If you care to join us, you simply join us in the pews that are specially prepared. O thou who camest from above, the pure celestial fire to impart. The hymn is 471, 471, to the tune Hereford.